The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Doug Fine is a solar-powered goat herder, a comedic investigative journalist, and a pioneer voice in hemp and regenerative farming. He's cultivated hemp in 4 U.S. states, and his weed genetics are in 5 more. He's an award-winning culture and climate correspondent for NPR, The New York Times, and The Washington Post, among others. His books include Hemp Bound, Too High to Fail, Farewell My Subaru, Not Really an Alaskan Mountain Man, and First Legal Harvest. Doug has a new book out. It's just been released. It's called American Hemp Farmer. Available at bookstores everywhere, once bookstores are open again. It's published by Chelsea Green Publishing. Hey, Doug, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Doug.
So let's get right to it. Now, your new book is American Hemp Farmer. The title kind of says it all, but tell my listeners what it's about.
The resurgent hemp industry worldwide is the economist side of folks likes to point out the fastest agricultural-based economy to cross the $1 billion in annual revenue generation of any industry ever. And that's fantastic, but from my perspective, it only means something if the farmers are the beneficiaries of anything that comes out of the soil, especially with regenerative practices. Farmers have not been the primary financial beneficiaries, and we have the opportunity to change that in the hemp cannabis sphere. So I sort of explored what farmer-friendly models, farmer-first models might look like as hemp continues to surge.
You are a very strong proponent of organic farming in general. It's not just with hemp. Am I right you were into organics prior to becoming a hemp farmer?
Yes. My second book is called Farewell My Subaru, and it's about trying to live with modern comforts but without fossil fuels. And embedded in that is organic and regenerative food practices. And I like to think that I put very few non-organic foods into my body.
Well, you certainly seem healthy, so you look healthy, so it must be working.
Thank you. I hope so. Thanks.
Now, I'm curious, did getting involved with hemp have any impact on your perspective on organic farming? I mean, you're already into it, but did it have any impact on your perspective on it?
Huge impact. First of all, a fun practical impact. My home state is New Mexico, but I work in hemp and cultivate hemp in a number of places around the world. And one of the places where I have a direct entrepreneurial effort, a farm-to-table product growing, is in Vermont. And when I and my farming partners in Vermont had the USDA approved organic certifiers come out to our farm and then stamp our crop organic, a crop that 3 or 4 years earlier was in the Orwellian final days of the war on cannabis, a Schedule I felony, that was a remarkably good feeling in general, just in terms of official legitimacy. But when it comes to the idea of organic, I first of all think it's still a valuable stamp to have. I look for it if I'm not, let's say, at a farmer's market or I'm not growing food myself. I'm actually in, let's say, a food co-op. I look for it because it means a few important things. It's obviously not, when something is federally mandated for 300 million people, it's not going to be as strong probably as many of us would want, but it means something. These days, there's a lot of efforts on to improve on organics. In other words, alternate certifications that include things like fair trade and all that good stuff. I'm thinking of Brother David's cannabis certification. There's a lot of cool proposals out there. The main thing really is educated customers knowing about asking the right questions about regenerative practices. Organic is part of regenerative practices. And my definition overall of regenerative, Doug, is basically, are you leaving everything, not just your field, in as good condition or better as you found it? You know, basic kindergarten stuff. One example being, I do a very small run hemp products, farm-to-table organic product. And I ordered compostable, non-tree labels with non-toxic stickum, and so expensive. Between front and back label, we're talking $1 a bottle. But it's like we're in the ninth inning for humanity here from a climate change perspective, and there's no more time for putting these kind of decisions off. So I just bit the bullet, and I encourage everyone else to do that. You could do every part of your enterprise regeneratively these days. And that also means focusing it regionally, you know, not having an end game of getting bought out by a hedge fund or going public, but rather a long-term lucrative living for your family and your community.
In fact, I was just looking through Facebook, saw some kind of product that was supposed to be a hemp-based plastic container for the weed for dispensaries to use. Interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, but is that Santa Packaging? Those are nice guys. The folks on the radio won't be able to see this, but since you and I are communicating visually, yeah, this is U.S.-grown hemp plastic, 3D-printed in the form of a goat, since I'm a goat herder. Really, the Goodbye Pacific Garbage Patch movement is on. The End of Trash is the current National Geographic cover story, and hemp and other biomaterials, it can play a huge, huge role in that. It's a real thing. It's not just a righteous cutesy thing. It's we need to make every step in the industrial pipeline regenerative, or we go away as a species. You know, the earth will be fine.
Talk a little more about the environmental impact of hemp production. The plant itself has some impact, but also the products. I know Jack was, everybody likes to focus on the drug products, but hemp itself really does have a lot of potential, and it just seems to have more, oh God, I'll say the word, it seems to have more and more applications every day. Yes, you got me to say it.
I knew you were going to say it. We joked about it before we went on the air, all the buzzwords that are working our way into our dialogue. Yes,
you're heavy. You're just that kind of an influencer, Doug.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my goodness.
A little inside joke there for the benefit of us. So talk to me about the environment. Talk more about the environmental impact of hemp and hemp production.
Cultivation-wise, hemp can be the best of worlds or the worst of worlds. And the argument that I make in the new book, American Hemp Farmer, is that if we who decide to do things regeneratively are willing to make that our brand and to shout out that our top-shelf products are just that, they are actually superior in things like bioavailability and performance, precisely because we're focusing not just on immediate bottom line, but on sequestering carbon through good soil building practices, for instance, that's our brand. And if we can educate customers that those are the products to seek out, you know, it's a sort of an extension of the know your farmer concept for anything that you buy that's food. But beyond that, know your regenerative farmer. Ask questions like, are you building soil? And to give you one example of the side of it that is not the way that I love to grow, I'm a little against the current trend in the hemp side of growing Sensimilla style. Don't get me wrong, I love all sides of the plant, big fan of Sensimilla, but I grow dioecious hemp, male and female hemp, with the argument that everyone's happier when they're dating, that there may be a hormonal balance kind of thing, and it's a little bit against the grain, not against the grain for the last 8,000 years, against the grain for the last 10 years when folks started cultivating cannabis hemp for specific cannabinoids other than THC. The first big rush was CBD, but now there's a big rush for CBG on. I really like CBC, but in truth, I'm a whole plant kind of guy in life in general. I don't extract lycopene and take it in a pill. I eat tomatoes, for instance. So with hemp cannabis, I'm not really that interested in jacking up one or the other. I'm interested in varieties that have developed in a locale and have what you might call terroir, like a fine wine or a fine cheese. That's the market that I'm interested in, not how many, milligrams of CBD are in every bottle of this tincture or what percentage of this flower is just one or two cannabinoids. I'm much more interested in a balance, right? So when you are growing outdoors under God's sun in the soil by organic regenerative means and growing dioecious, and by the way, the bees, we're all into Save the Bees, where it's the new Save the Whales, right? They love male hemp flowers, by the way, the best. When you're growing dioecially, you're kind of doing it as farmers have always done it in a way that's very natural. And that doesn't mean that Sensimilla style can't be grown regeneratively and organic. But when I hear folks making the pitch, oh, I grow my CBD organically in this organic approved plastic wrapping. I plug clones grown out of state somewhere in the ground in soil that I bought out of a bag and plug it through cloud. And guess what? It's organic. Everything's organic. I mean, yeah, that's a lot better than spraying, you know, a toxin poison all over it. But then you're plowing the plastic back under and then folks are like, oh, it's biodegradable. Like, God didn't make petroplastics. Sorry. So, you know, everything comes from nature, of course, but it's all about how things are, the environments in which our plants feel comfortable. And I think many of us now, I was late, Doug, coming to the awareness about plant intelligence. I was always an animal guy, you know, got along great with cats and dogs. And, you know, a raven once talked to me in Alaska, and I got to see a jaguar with their kittens on a rafting trip in the Amazon once. So I've always had these sort of totemic animal relationships, and only through the journalistic and then now personal work with the cannabis hemp plant have I recognized plant intelligence. And one of the things I believe plants are telling us is that what we see coming out of the soil, a beautiful hemp plant or tomato plant, is the result of a very happy microbial kingdom in that soil. And that's not an overnight phenomenon. That's about things like building your local microbes. Just to give one quick example, this is something I learned from a practitioner of Korean natural farming, a type of soil building agriculture, that you can go up into your watershed, and I've done this and it works, gather mycelial like mushroom crust from wet parts of your upper watershed, dilute it in this sort of rice mixture, and then use it as a compost tea, and all of a sudden you have much higher mushroom, you know, microbial mycelia life in your soil, and it results, I believe, in a better hemp crop. So when we're talking about the environment, all of these type of practices which give you a better product in the end are actually the practices that sequester carbon and have a chance of giving us humans an option after fossil fuels.
You're listening to an interview with Doug Fine, the journalist and hemp activist. His new book is American Hemp Farmer, published by Chelsea Green Publishing. We'll have more in just a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Louis Reed is the national organizer for the Cut 50 campaign, which is organized by the Dream Corps. He was one of the speakers in Council on Criminal Justice's recent webinar entitled Corrections and COVID-19, Challenges and Strategies.
In our minds, we don't think that this takes you having more degrees than a thermometer in order to be able to do something. First and foremost, we need to make sure that we are identifying people who are scheduled to be released from prisons or jails within the next 6 months. And we need to get those individuals out into home confinement, barring a specific reason not to do so. That's number one. The second thing is that we think that we need to parole people who are over the age of 65 with priority given to those individuals who have pre-existing and or other underlying health conditions that make them particularly susceptible to the virus. That's number two. Number three, we need to suspend co-pays for medical visits for people who are incarcerated when they have to go down to medical. All of that stuff needs to be suspended. The next thing, we need to make sure that hand sanitizer stations and or other personal hygiene products are available to people who are incarcerated free of charge. I personally, as someone who did almost 14 years in federal prison, I think that it's absolutely asinine that you have a state like New York that are having people produce hand sanitizing equipment where the offender population can't necessarily use it because it's considered a contraband. And last but not least, we need to make sure that we are implementing smart social distancing policies to protect the more than 4.5 million people who are under some form of community supervision. So look, this is not a matter of our heads. This is a matter of our hearts. And ultimately, in time, our values are going to be interrogated, they are going to be prosecuted, and they are going to be evaluated by how we responded to the so-called least of these.
That was Louis Reed, national organizer for the Cut 50 campaign. He was speaking in a webinar on corrections and COVID-19, which was organized by the Council on Criminal Justice. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, let's get back to my conversation with the journalist, farmer, and hemp activist, Doug Fine. You've been on quite a journey with this plant this last 8-10 years. How did it all start?
Well, I'll answer that directly, but I'm really glad that you asked that question, because having what you might call the creds of someone that clearly cares about all sides of the plant and the farmers of all sides of the plant, my end game, not just mine, I'm just a mouthpiece for many people who feel this way, is the return to the reality that this is just one plant, that the delineation that we have today between cannabis and hemp is something that hopefully will go away and can and should go away. And if it's okay, I'll explain why. First off, the definition of hemp as we have it today, legally, was the result of a 1976 paper, a Canadian paper, Small and Shepherd researchers. And they said that they arbitrarily chose this based on studying a whole bunch of different varieties of, like, well, hey, it makes sense to call everything on this side of here hemp, right? And interestingly, they suggested a testing method that's much more friendly than the flower cola bud testing that's often done today. They suggested testing the leaves of the plant, which we know could do contain ratios of cannabinoids, but not nearly in the amount that the buds do. I mention this only because it's an important wonky policy issues for hemp farmer right now, because we're trying to do everything we can to get the burden off of farmers during tests, right? So on the 0.3 delineation of 1976, people today just assume that there are these two different plants, but actually, for all of history, it's been one plant. Whether or not you were looking for roofing, sandals, a superfood, or a party favor, it was just your cannabis plant. People didn't even know, what was it, 64, that THC even got isolated and identified. So I think it's important that we return back to this concept of one plant. And I'll give you two quick reasons why. One is, when you are growing we talked a little earlier about hemp plastic. When you're growing for a fiber application like that, or clothing, or hempcrete feedstock, or animal bedding, or all the, you know, rocket parts, or any of it, you don't necessarily want the lowest possible THC to make the strongest fiber. Now, no one's going to smoke that flower, at least not commercially. So it should be the burden should be off the farmer on the THC. It should be completely irrelevant. It should be cannabis that's legal to grow, and no farmer of any kind of cannabis, even ganja farmers in the Emerald Triangle, no farmer should be subject to THC testing until and unless a final flower product that is potential psychoactivity is going to be making it to the public, into the retail market. And when I first floated this, and others floated this a few years ago, people thought it sounded so crazy. Now there's a whole movement on. It really just makes sense, and it's about protecting farmers.
Of course, now, you do a lot more than hemp, obviously. You have testified at the United Nations in Vienna before the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, where you represented ENCOD, the European Coalition for Just and Effective Drug Policies. Are you still involved in the international scene in your copious spare time?
Yeah, when I'm not homeschooling the kids and milking goats and stuff. So, by the way, Doug, I just have to say, as I go into answer this question, that you are proof of what Bob Marley used to say. He didn't say let's get high, he'd say let's get steady. I mean, you have like a nearly photographic memory, and that's, I can't believe that you can just off the top of your head remember and list all that stuff. But so yes, the hemp movement is very much an international phenomenon. I've been participating in efforts to bring hemp back, ranging from the Netherlands to Hawaii, and talking now about places like Haiti and Ethiopia. So I'm interested in, you know, we need to build soil the world over. India is another place that has a lot of interest and a lot of potential and a lot of history. So it is an international phenomenon. And just to tie a loose end on one of your earlier questions about how did this all start for me, it started for me since you've been working so fervently to bring about the cannabis piece for longer than I have. You'll recognize the story that spurred me to first start researching cannabis hemp professionally as a journalist and as an author. And that was I live really remote in New Mexico, and you know when there's a car where it's not one of the ranchers on the area coming in, when it's like 30 cars of all kinds of agencies with guys with earpieces coming out and automatic weapons and helicopters flying overhead, you know that there's something weird going on. And what was going on in 2010 was a close neighbor of mine, like physically, you know, he was, you know, probably couldn't hear if I shouted to him right now, but what passes for close neighbor, he's a retiree from a corporation, mellow guy. He has grown 11 or so plants for PTSD mitigation in Vietnam. He's a veteran, and someone who had a falling out with him tipped off our law enforcement folks, and millions of dollars were spent on these few plants, put my family at risk with automatic weapons that could go off. I had to drive through them to get home, and we know that kind of thing is insane. We're going to be laughing about it when we tell our kids and grandkids about it. But to answer your earlier question, this is actually what spurred me to spend a good, you know, portion of my career energy for quite a number of years figuring out what the we all knew we were going to – we have a love affair with this plant. Humanity has loved this plant. It was a camp follower. Anthropologists call it a camp follower. Before we were even sedentary farmers, we were carrying it around in our pouches and pockets because it provides a lot of great, valuable things. And we knew that we were going to return to the plant, but the question was, how would it look in a way that was good for humanity? And that's what I've been investigating for the last 10 or so years.
Let's get back to hemp. That's American Hemp Farmer. That is the name of your new book. There are a lot of companies in the CBD market these days. Hemp-derived cannabidiol, CBD is everywhere. It's the big box stores, the corner shops. CBD, you know, kind of seems to be the thing that's pushing hemp forward. Now, is that a misperception? Is that actually the case? Are those other products going to become just byproducts made with the waste material once CBD's been extracted?
Well, CBD is definitely a gold rush, and there was gold, let's say in the 49er gold rush in California, there was gold to be had. People want CBD, you know, as they should. I eat cannabinoids every day. As I mentioned, I'm more of a whole plant guy than isolating one cannabinoid, but it's a real thing, feeding our endocannabinoid systems. I mean, there's a reason we evolved endocannabinoid systems, so it's a real thing, and it's worth many, many billions of dollars. But as in any gold rush, it's very few of the actual prospectors are the people who strike it rich. It's the people who sell them the shovels and the flour and all of that. Some of those businesses and stores are still, like I lived in Alaska for a while, some of the ancestors of the people that sold the coffee and the bags and the mules are still in Skagway, Alaska, because they did great. So we're seeing that today through things like wholesalers, people that sell processing equipment, or just outside investors. So the task at hand is, how does a multi-billion-dollar market, no matter what side of the hemp plant we're talking about, how does that benefit rural communities and farmers? It would be nice if we did not need a farm aid anymore, just as, you know, as much as I love the music. It'd be nice if farming was a lucrative profession like dentistry or something. Like, it would be fantastic when we reach the point of 30% of Americans making their living from the soil, as was the case when federal cannabis prohibition started in 1937. So just as I was started to research this book, American Hemp Farmer, and in fact, after a field day, I was in my field with my partners in Vermont, I was hanging out and I noticed I had a voicemail, and it was from Wendell Berry, the great farmer philosopher from Kentucky, now in his 80s. I had written to him on hemp paper at P.O. Box 1 in whatever town in Kentucky, and asked him to attend a hemp conference that some friends were organizing not far from where he lived, and he called back immediately. And in his voicemail, which I've saved, he said, my one real message for hemp farmers is, please do your own thing. I'm just paraphrasing here. He didn't say influencer or app, by the way. He said, please do your own thing, market your products, control your products, because if you're just a wholesale surf to the vicissitudes of the buyers, you're going to face the same, you know, destitution and problems, and not to mention environmental destruction, that farmers of nearly every other crop have faced around the country and around the world. So that has stayed with me as a number one mission, that regardless of what products the market demands, that farmers be the ones who are benefiting at that retail dollar. Today, farmers get about 3%, 3 cents on the food dollar. And the goal that I and many others share, this was told by told to me by a friend at a great organic hemp cooperative in Colorado. He said, our goal is farmers getting 100 cents on the dollar less expenses. There should be nobody else involved, just the farmers getting paid. And, you know, that's an extreme position and I support it, but it comes down to if you're forming an enterprise, you should either be the, in my view, sorry, you should be the farmer, or the farmer should be a co-owner, revenue sharer in that operation and not a wholesale wage slave. And then just to come back to your original question, while CBD is a gold rush, it's also giving way to the next best thing now. A lot of farmers now are looking for CBG heavy crops. We've got 100 plus known cannabinoids. But the niche I'm going for sidesteps that a little bit and is looking for the idea of, imagine you're in Sonoma, some beautiful wine country somewhere, and you go into a fine wine shop, that top shelf offering that has a particular varietal from that year. That's what I'm looking for. It's what I try to cultivate myself. Or if, you know, if somebody's inviting us over for dinner and we want to bring over a wonderful hemp product, whatever it is, tincture, book, shirt, look for the real farmer cultivated top shelf, regionally made, distinctive, product. You go and take a trip to Botswana, you're not bringing home somebody, I hope you're not bringing home somebody, you know, a fridge magnet that says Botswana. You're bringing home someone a really cool craft from there that someone made. And that's how the niche hemp market, the high-end craft market that I feel I represent and not exclusively speak for, but the people that I'm trying to support are these type of family and community-based hemp providers, no matter what the side of the plant. In my own product, I don't just use the flower. I also use the seed being a superfood. So I don't think flower only, let alone CBD only, is the long-term play for hemp farmers. The question is, are folks in it for the long-term play? If you're a desperate farmer who's saying, you know, I'm about to sell to sub-developers, I'm not making any money from my GMO soy or whatever, I'd like to give this hemp thing a try. It's real easy. Read my book. You'll see. We should have a 3 to 5 year game plan, and they've got mortgages this year. So it's a gut check. Any entrepreneurialism is gut check, whether or not it's dependent on the whims of Mother Nature. But in particular, it's important for hemp entrepreneurs to have a long-term game plan and not just chase the latest gold rush. Somebody else is going to grow the CBD for a chain drugstore or Coke CBD. You know it's coming. The big Mac CBD or whatever is coming. That's not going to be you and me. We're going to be the people that are doing something better and different. And hopefully that is a market niche that customers will patronize.
That was my conversation with Doug Fine. His new book is American Hemp Farmer, published by Chelsea Green Publishing. Find him on the web at DougFine.com and on social media where he's at Organic Cowboy. And for now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.